pleasure to be here today. Thanks. I thank everyone for coming out to listen to the presentation and hear about my book. Growing up, I knew the basic history of my dad's World War II experiences. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was with the 8th Air Force stationed in England. He flew bombing missions over occupied Europe. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. His plane was shot down over Belgium in 1944, and he was missing in action for 7 months. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I actually had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. It was never my intention to write a book at that time. Really, all I wanted to do was read and to organize all the material that my parents had kept from the war years. And there were two really significant items. One was a diary that my dad had handwritten while he was missing in action about his plane going down. And it was absolutely riveting, so much so that the account of his plane being shot down was included in two different books that were written. One by Gerald Astor called The Mighty Eighth, about the 8th Air Force, which was stationed in England. The 8th Air Force was called the Mighty Eighth because of the number of planes they could put up on combat missions, numbering in the hundreds. And in December of 1944, they had 2,000 bombers and 1,000 fighters on one mission. The other book, First Over Germany, was by Russell Strong. It was about the 306 bomb group, which my dad was in. Russell Strong was a navigator in the 306 and became its historian after the war. The motto for the 306 was First Over Germany because it was the first bomb group to bomb a target within Germany. And the other item of great interest were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother during the war. And sitting down and reading those was absolutely fascinating. And I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I started joining a number of World War II organizations. Today I'm president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association. Started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And then finally in 2012, I decided to write a book. I was actually at a reunion of the 306 Bomb Group in Savannah, Georgia. And I came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it had to be told, and people needed to read about it. It took me 4.5 years from the time I started my research to the time the book was published. It took me 12 months to actually write the manuscript and then another 8 months to publish it. I published it myself. I formed a one-person limited liability company and then contracted with independent professionals for all the services associated with publishing a book, such as editing, cover design, interior layout, printing, etc. The book has done very well. It's won 17 National Book Awards since its release in August of 2014, and it's in all the major air museums across the United States, even the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. But I might not have ever written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen. The first is Paul Delahaye, seen here with my father in 1994 at the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and of my dad's plane being shot down. And the other gentleman was Jacques Lalot, seen here with me in 2014 at the 70th anniversary. Both these men were young boys during the war, and they saw firsthand the atrocities that the Nazis committed during their occupation of Belgium from 1940 to 1944. And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed quite a few people that were either citizens or members of the Belgium underground and recorded their testimony about the events that took place. I owe them a huge debt, because the events that took place and the documentation of those events would have been lost forever if they hadn't have written it all down and provided it to me to put in my book. They're both wonderful gentlemen. Paul actually died in 2013. Jacques, who I'm gonna see next month, I'm going back over to Belgium, he's 75 years old. My dad didn't join the Air Force or the Army Air Corps back then to begin with, as a result of President Franklin Roosevelt's implementing the first ever peacetime draft in the fall of 1940, my dad enlisted in the Army, and he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. At the time, the U.S. military was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in the world in military strength behind Romania. And as you can see here, my dad wearing this old World War I uniform, they were very ill-equipped as well. 3 months later in July, my dad married Ruth Hempel. She was born in Pasadena, as was I. This is their wedding picture at First Lutheran Church in Pasadena. It was shortly after she graduated from UCLA. My dad was actually born in Norfolk, Nebraska, and then moved to Glendale when he was 13. That December, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, and the United States went to war. During the Christmas time of that year, my mother went up to visit my dad over the holidays, and 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, my dad was feeling a little pressure. He had a brand new bride, a baby on the way, and he felt, how am I going to be able to support my family on a private's pay in the Army? So he decided to join the Air Force where he could make a little more money, and especially if he could make it through pilot school and become an officer. In June of 1942, he went through pre-flight training here in Santa Ana, and then he went through the various stages of pilot training. This slide's a little difficult to see, but there were three basic stages of pilot training. The first was primary, and then if you could make it through that, you went into basic. And in basic, they split the pilots out before they went into advanced training. They either went into single-engine fight planes or fighters, or they went into advanced two-engine planes or bombers or transports. Typically, the shorter pilots went into single-engine planes or fighters because of the cramped conditions in the cockpit of fighters. My dad was almost 6'3", so he wouldn't fit in there too well. But also was determined by personality. The fighter pilots tended to be a little more individualistic, risk-takers, a little cocky. And the bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. Here you see my dad in primary training at Santa Maria in California. I think pretty much everyone smoked back then. These are the three planes that he flew during the three stages of pilot training. At Santa Maria, he flew an old Stearman biplane. And then in basic training, he flew a Vulti Valiant single-wing aircraft. He went through basic in Lemoore, California, and Marana, Arizona. And then in advanced training, he flew a Curtiss Wright twin-engine plane. He graduated from advanced training in Douglas, Arizona in April of 1943, where he received his pilot's wings and his commission as a second lieutenant. Then he went to transitional training, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17. And after that, he went to operational crew training in Dalhart, Texas, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. Then on October 21st of 1943, they reported to the 306 Bomb Group at Thurlow, England. This is what the airfield looked back then. It's no longer there. There's a nice little museum there, though. But the countryside pretty much looks the same. It's all farmland, rural, with little country roads running through it. It's very quaint. My wife and I visited there in 2014. Here you see the insignia of the 306 Bomb Group. There were three air divisions in the 8th Air Force. They were part of the 1st Air Division, signified by the triangle. And each bomb group had a letter designation. H was the 306th. Some of you might remember or recall the movie 12 O'Clock High, starring Gregory Peck. Well, that was based on a true story about the 306 Bomb Group. The fictitious bomb group in the movie, the 918th, was derived by multiplying the 306th by three. Okay. There were four squadrons in the bomb group. You had the 367th, Clay Pigeon, so named by a journalist because they took such heavy losses during the war. Then you had the Eager Beavers, the Grim Reapers, and then my dad's squadron, the 369th, Fightin' Bitin'. I always like to show this next slide because it's of the ground crew. The combat crews got all the glory and the recognition, but these guys really kept these planes flying. They really considered the plane theirs and they just lent it to the combat crews to fly on missions. But when these planes came back after a mission, these guys would stay up all through the night doing maintenance, repairing battle damage, rearming the plane, refueling. So they were really the unsung heroes. Here you see my dad's crew. A B-17 had a 10-man crew. The They had four officers. My dad, in the lower left, was the first pilot. And then you had the co-pilot, the navigator, and bombardier. And then you had six enlisted men, or non-commissioned officers, who were mainly gunners. Five of these men made it back. Five of them did not. This is not the Susan Ruth. That's just the plane that they took their picture in front of when they arrived in England. You'll notice the nose art up here. I love the nose art. It's interesting that the 8th Air Force, or the Air Force, I should say, was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Marines did not, or the Navy did not, neither did any other country. But 8th Bomber Command thought it would help morale if they could let these young guys paint their planes and personalize their planes. And they're very creative in what they named their planes and painted on their planes. Oftentimes it was a cartoon character, but more often than not, it was a nude woman. The 306 Bomb Group flew B-17 bombers, nicknamed a Flying Fortress because of the armament that they carried on the plane. They carried 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns. Also, they could take a tremendous amount of battle damage and keep flying. Again, you see the triangle H on the tail that identified that plane as part of the 306 Bomb Group. There were three different models of B-17s flown in the war. This is the later model of B-17G, which you can tell by the chin turret under the nose. Here you see the crew positions on the plane. In the up front in the plexiglass nose, you have the bombardier, behind him the navigator, then the two pilots up above him, the top turret gunner, who was also the flight engineer. Then you have the bomb bays separating him from the radio operator, ball turret gunner, two waist gunners, and a tail gunner. The bombs hung on racks on each side of the plane. This slide's a little difficult to see, but you'll see the bombs hanging on here on one side of the plane. And then there was a narrow catwalk, 8 inches wide, in between them. And this boy's only 8 years old, so you can see how narrow that catwalk was. And it wasn't uncommon for bombs to get hung up in the racks, and one of the crew members would have to take a wrench and knock it loose or kick it loose with his foot. So you can imagine what that must have been like. When those bomb bay doors are open, he's looking straight down to the earth, 5 miles down below, the wind howling all around him. So that must have been pretty nerve-wracking doing that. Here you see the crew positions a little more clearly. Again, you have the bombardier up front. This was the earlier model, the F model. It doesn't have the chin turret. His job is to bomb them, or drop the bombs accurately. But on the G model, when they were under attack, he also manned the chin turret. Then you had the navigator. He needed to know where they were going and where they were. And then the two pilots up above him. You needed two pilots, most obviously, because if one was injured or killed, you had another pilot to fly the plane. But you needed two pilots just to share the duty of flying the plane. It was very strenuous, both mentally and physically. These missions lasted 8 to 10 hours. And flying in tight formations, they had to stay real alert or else they'd run into a plane in front of them or clip a wing on a plane next to them. Also, they had to fight the turbulence, not only the turbulence from the air, and I'm sure all of you have been in planes where you drop and bounce around. But having this many planes in the air at one time, all that prop watch and chop from all these engines really stirred up the air and caused it very difficult to fly. Again, you have the flight engineer who manned the top turret when they were under attack. But his main function was also to help the pilots monitor all the instruments in the plane. There were only over 150 different toggles and switches and gauges. So the flight engineer helped the pilots monitor engine performance and fuel consumption. And then behind the bomb bay, you have the radio operator. That was the most comfortable position on the plane. He had a nice chair to sit in and a roomy compartment. And then the most cramped position on the plane was the ball turret gunner down here. And again, these missions were 8 to 10 hours. So this guy is curled up in a fetal position for all that length of time. You can imagine how comfortable that must have been. Actually, the ball turret was the safest position to be in the plane. A lot of people think it might be the most dangerous, but it wasn't. And then up above the ball turret gunner, again, you have the two waist gunners and then the tail gunner, which is also a very cramped position. On November 3rd of 1943, my father and his crew flew their first combat mission. I was on a bombing mission to Wilhelmshaven, Germany. It was the first mission where the 8th Air Force had over 500 bombers. And flying combat was brutal and it was dangerous. From the time you took off to the time you landed, It was very, very difficult. To begin with, you had 40 bomb groups in an area called East Anglia here in England. It's about the size or area of Vermont. So on the day of a mission, you had hundreds of planes taking off from all these bases at the same time. And back then, there was no air traffic control. There was no radar. Everything was based on visual sight. And usually the English weather was overcast and you couldn't see anything until you got above the clouds. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. And then they had to form up. Individual planes had to form up into elements. Elements formed up into squadrons. Squadrons formed up into bomb groups. Bomb groups formed up into combat wings. Combat wings formed up into divisions. And all this took an hour to 2 hours before they ever headed across the English Channel on their mission. And then they had to deal with the elements. These planes were not pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they needed to go on oxygen, or else they'd pass out, and in a couple of minutes, they'd be dead. Also, they had to deal with the cold. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero in these planes. So frostbite was a major problem. A lot of these airmen were hospitalized with frostbite injuries. Here you see a waist gunner in a typical combat uniform. Had a steel helmet on, tinted goggles because of the brightness at that altitude. Again, the oxygen mask they had to be on. This is a flak jacket. It was like an apron that had metal plates in the front and back to protect them. And you have the thermal fleece-lined jacket, thermal boots and gloves. And you see here the white part, that's a parachute harness. They didn't actually wear their parachutes in the plane because it was too cramped. If they needed to bail out, they had to have the wherewithal to find their parachute and then hook it on the clamps on the back of the harness and then bail out. When they neared the mainland of Europe, then they had another problem, and that was they had to deal with German fighters. The Germans had radar stations along the coast and knew when these formations were going to reach mainland Europe, and they were those German planes, the Air Force, the Luftwaffe, were just waiting for those formations. Here you have a waist gunner firing his 50 caliber machine gun. Again, his flak jacket here, all these spent cartridges on the ground. They were all clipped together in a belt that would feed the gun here. At the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these bombers flying in tight formations with all that armament could defend themselves against the German fighters, but that turned out not to be the case. In 1942 and 1943, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. Finally, they gave them some fighter support, but the problem initially was that those fighters, the P-38 Lightnings and the P-47 Thunderbolts, didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way to the target and back. They could make it just over mainland Europe a little ways, and they had to turn back to England. Well, the German fighters would just hover in the air and just wait for them to turn around, and then they'd swoop down on them. Here you see what was called a combat box formation. And this was designed to interlace all the firepower from these planes with the thought that they could defend themselves. This is a box of a combat wing. Within the combat wing, you had three combat groups, so the 306 would have been in one box, and two other combat groups within those boxes, and then three squadrons in boxes inside of those. Here you see a little different view from on top of the formation, from the side, and then here head on. Once they got closer to the target, then they had another problem to deal with, and that was anti-aircraft fire. Here you see a German anti-aircraft cannon. They fired shells about 20 a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same height that the formation was flying. And when these shells exploded, they were full of all sorts of shapes and sizes of metal, pieces of metal called shrapnel, that would just burst out hundreds of feet. They could easily penetrate the skin of these planes. The aluminum skin was so thin you could take a screwdriver and just poke right through it. From a distance, the flak, it was called, it was an abbreviation of the German word for an aircraft cannon. They looked like little innocent black puffs, but as you got closer and closer, those puffs got bigger and they started rocketing these ships. You can imagine the adrenaline in these airmen when they saw those shells exploding up ahead and knew they had to fly right into them, a direct hit it would basically disintegrate the plane and it'd disappear. If it hit a wing, it'd knock it off, they'd drop like a stone. So they always had that fear. They hated the flak more than they did the fighters, because at least the fighters, they could fight back. As they got very close to the target, they reached a point called the IP, the initial point, and that's where the first pilot gave command of the plane over to the bombardier, who flew the plane through this device called a Norden bomb sight. It was revolutionary at the time. It was an analog computer that could calculate the speed of the plane, crosswind, the wind speed, so the bombardier could accurately drop the bombs. Here you see the bombardier looking through the crosshairs of the Norden bomb sight. When he dropped the bombs, he would yell "bombs away," and then the first pilot would take control of the plane again, and then they would all peel off and go to a point called the rally point, where they'd try to form up again and then head back to Europe. It was on a mission to Frankfurt on February 8th of 1944, my dad's plane dropped his bomb successfully, but their bomb bay got hit by flak and they couldn't get the bomb bay doors back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane and they lost airspeed and couldn't keep up with the formation heading back to England. And they were picked out or singled out by two Focke-Wulf German fighter planes who came in and swooped in to attack the Susan Ruth. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Although both those German fighter planes were shot down as well. One piloted by Siegfried Merrick crashed and he died in the plane. The other was piloted by Hans Berger, who bailed out and he made it through the war. When I was doing my research, my wife asked me one day, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to do that. It's a crazy idea. But being a good husband, I listened to my wife, and lo and behold, I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war and speaks perfect English, so we communicated by email and over the phone. And he gave me some wonderful insight about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. Here you see a picture of the Susan Ruth after it came down. This picture was taken by an unknown Belgian. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book of the people involved and the places where the events took place. The helpers of my dad sent him a tremendous amount of pictures from the war, and also the two Belgian gentlemen I mentioned, Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot, provided me with lots of pictures from that time era as well. My dad, being the first pilot and commander of the plane, was the last one to bail out. Again, this picture was sent to him by one of his helpers who actually helped him out of these trees. His parachute came down, it was around noontime, and they got hung up in the trees and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. Fortunately for him, there were a couple young Belgian farmers that saw his plight. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder to help him down. They told him to stay put until nightfall because there were German patrols combing the area looking for these airmen that had bailed out. That night they came and got him and took him to this farmhouse, which is still there today. It's right on the French border. In fact, these trees are in France. He stayed there one night. They didn't think it was safe for him to stay there any longer than that one night because of the German patrols in the area. And a Belgian customs officer by the name of Paul Tilquin came and got him on a tandem bicycle. He brought another uniform that my dad changed into, and they headed out. It was pitch black, middle of the night, raining cats and dogs, and my dad had shrapnel wounds in one leg, so he could only pedal when the pedal came around with his good foot or his good leg. They came to a hill, and he wasn't able to pedal anymore, and so they had to get off and push the bike up the hill. And at the top of the hill was a cabaret or a little cafe. The lights were on, music was playing, there was laughter coming out of the cafe, and when they got up near it, two German officers came walking out with young girls, their arms were on young girls. One of them came up to my dad, put his arm around him and asked for a light for a cigarette. My dad couldn't speak any German, so he was scared to death. Fortunately, Paul could, gave him a light, and the Germans let him go on their way. I guess they were too drunk and too interested in their girls to pay these guys much attention. And my dad had several close calls, almost being captured by the Germans, which are described in the book. My dad became good friends with Paul, and especially his wife Nellie. Paul was arrested and sent to prison and tortured. He narrowly escaped being executed, but it did break his health, and he died in his mid-50s. From there, my dad was moved around from place to place. How long he stayed in any particular house depended on how brave the people were that lived there, and also how dangerous the underground thought it was for him to stay there. Here you see two of his helpers, Ghislaine Bayou on the left and Jeanette Gadin on the right. Jeanette's husband was a captain in the French army. He had been captured by the Germans and spent the war in a prisoner of war camp. But my dad corresponded with these helpers after the war. Typically, when an airman bailed out and evaded capture, the underground tried to get him back to England, down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. And you can imagine the stress you'd be under being a downed airman. You're in a foreign land. You don't know what happened to your crew buddies. You can't speak the language. You can't communicate back home. And at any moment, the Gestapo can come in on and raid the house and arrest you and either send you to a prisoner of war camp or you could be shot. So finally, my dad got tired of hiding. So he decided to join the French resistance, the group called the Mackie. They were a guerrilla group that harassed the Germans, sabotaged convoys, executed, or not executed, but shot German officers when they could. This is the farmhouse that the Mackie group stayed in. This was actually just across the border in France. And this farmhouse is still there today. My dad stayed in the upper rooms, another little vignette is one day that my dad was shaving. He just had his skivvies on and shaving cream in his face, and a German troop came up the road, and he had to jump out the windows there and hightail it into the woods. Whoops. Sorry about that. Here's another pretty incredible picture. It shows my dad jumping out of a Jeep with the Mackie group on one of their escapades and fighting the Germans. Finally, my dad was liberated on September 2nd, 7 months after he was missing in action by Patton's Third Army, when he came up through France after D-Day. He was liberated in a little French town called Treslong. So you might realize that Brussels is really separated. It's in two parts. The upper half is called Flanders, where they speak Dutch, and it's rather industrial, the larger cities. And the lower half of Belgium is called Wallonia, where they speak French, and it's very rural, all farmland, and just basically made up of little hamlets and villages. And my dad's plane and most of the crew came down right around here, again, right at the French border. My dad was hidden in Charleroi for a little bit. That farmhouse where the resistance group was right over the border, and then Treslong was right about here. I've been to Belgium 3 times. It's a wonderful country, and the people are just wonderful as well. To this day, they're so thankful and grateful for the Americans coming to their rescue and liberating them from Nazi occupation. They have celebrations there every year. This is a poster from 2014 when I went back. And the celebrations last several days. They erect a huge tent, this is just part of it, that can seat hundreds and hundreds of people, and we have a grand old time. You have dances, band concerts, they have lunches and dinners. All the local helpers dress up in World War II vintage uniforms, and the local beer Chimay flows freely. Everyone has a real good time. They also have ceremonies at various memorials around the area. This is the one at Cendron, which is right at the French-Belgian border where the 9th Infantry, the U.S. 9th Infantry, first crossed over into France to liberate Belgium. And all the local villagers come out, all the local dignitaries are there, the U.S. Army, the Belgium military, French military. This, in 2014, even the U.S. ambassador to Belgium, Denise Bauer, came down and she invited me and my family over to her residence at the embassy in Brussels, which was very special. They also have ceremonies at this memorial, which is the Susan Ruth Memorial. It's in the little village called Mackinaws, pretty close to where the plane came down. On the front are plaques that have the names of the crew, their ages at the time that they crashed down, or bailed out, or shot down, and their positions in the crew. This is Hans Berger today, that German Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane. He's 92 years old. He lives in Munich, Germany. I'm going to go visit him next month and film him. I've never met him in person. This picture was taken by my youngest son, who happened to be in Germany. My dad wanted to visit the World War II memorial before he died, so I accompanied him on a reunion for the Air Force Escape and Evasion Society back to Pennsylvania, and we took a bus down to Washington, D.C. It was just before its official dedication in 2004. My dad wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest crew member to die at age 91. And virtually all of the World War II vets are in their 90s today. At one time, there were 16 million World War II veterans, and today 95% of them are no longer with us. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died, millions more were wounded, millions more homeless and displaced. It changed the course of America and the world forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are surely members of the greatest generation. We can never forget their sacrifice, and it's our duty to remember. Thank you. Wow. I'd be glad to take some questions if anyone has any. Yes, sir.
Were the two German planes that shot Susan Ruth down shot down themselves by the guns from that aircraft or from fighters?
Yeah, the Susan Ruth gunners, I'm not sure which one, shot down Hans Berger's plane, but they're unsure actually who was credited with shooting down Siegfried Merrick's plane. It was really difficult to tell who shot down planes there. The closing speed in those planes was so fast, and you have all these gunners shooting them at them at the same time. So really identifying a kill was difficult. Yes, sir.
Did your father have to bail out then, or was he able to fly the airplane down to the ground?
Well, two of the crew died in the plane, and the other eight bailed out. So the plane came down. My dad put it on autopilot before he bailed out. And the plane didn't come straight down. It kind of swirled down. The tail fell off, and one of the engines fell off.
And then did he find out what happened to the other eight members?
He never knew at all what happened to his crew until he got back to England. And even then he found out that two of them had died. Some of them were in prison camps. And there were three that were still unaccounted for, which he thought they were in prison camps. Yes, sir.
What tour was he on when the plane went down?
He was on his eighth mission.
Eight?
Yeah, he had flown two more, but they were recalled because of weather. His other crew members actually had more missions than him. He was the center on the basketball team, and he tore the ligaments in his ankle, and he couldn't fly for 2 months. So some of his other crew members actually had more missions than he did.
How long was it before your mother found out that he was living? You said he was missing in action for 6 months?
7 months. And it was probably 8 months before. The plane went down on February 8th. On February 23rd, she got a telegram from the War Department saying that he was missing in action. And that April, my other sister was born. So my dad didn't even know what, he always thought he was going to have a boy. In the letters, he always called the baby Steve or Stevie, but it turned out to be Nancy. And then my mother didn't know that he was alive until he came back to England in September, and he sent her a telegram.
With those tight formations, how were they able to not shoot each other?
That's a good question, and it comes up all the time. I'm not exactly sure. They had certain cones of fire, and that they practiced. And some of the guns, I think, you know, were calibrated that they could only swing so far. But all that interlocking fire, you'd think they would hit each other. After my dad got back to England, then he came home. If you were shot down over enemy territory, you couldn't fly again, because they thought if you were shot down a second time and you were captured by the Germans and tortured, you'd give up the identity of those people that helped you the first time that you were shot down. There were, if you were shot down over, you know, once after D-Day, and then the troops came in and started occupying France and Belgium and Netherlands, and if you were shot down over U.S.-occupied territory, then you could fly again.
So did he learn enough French to be able to talk to the people he was serving with in the mob?
Yeah, well, in the escape kit of every crewman, you had a little French, you know, English dictionary. But by the time, after that 7 months, my dad said he could speak pretty good conversational French.
Like, shoot and...
Well, he could yeah, because there, at one of the houses he was at, there was a 16-year-old girl, Mimi Gabriel was her name, that they used to play cards and play Monopoly, and she would teach him French. Those, the people that hid and aided those downed airmen were incredibly brave. They were not only putting their own lives in danger, but those of their family as well. And some of the people that helped my dad or other members of the crew were arrested, sent to prison camps, and some lost their lives.
Why is that tail got a position not the most vulnerable on the plane?
Why wasn't the tail?
Or the ball. You
know, the ball? Yeah. Well, you're kind of hidden underneath the plane, so, and also most of the attacks were from above, either from the front or from the back, and so they didn't really come up from beneath the plane.
Mm-hmm. What about the most dangerous part?
The bombardier, you know, and then the navigator, because they're in that plexiglass nose and pretty vulnerable. The pilots kind of had a tight space where they were sitting. Yeah, the two men that died in the plane were the ball turret gunner. I said that wasn't the most dangerous position, and the radio operator.
Do you have an idea what the total number of B-17s was that was in the flight where your dad was shot down? And how many B-17s were lost from that flight?
It's in my book, but I forget off the top of my head how many bombers were flying that mission. But his plane was the only plane that was shot down on that mission. I mentioned how dangerous it was to fly combat. There were 26,000 men in the 8th Air Force that lost their lives in combat. That was more than the entire Marine Corps during World War II. And there was another 28,000 airmen that became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky. It was the most dangerous job in the Army. That's not the way we'd put it, really, but even more dangerous than being in infantry.
We used to say as kids, bombs away. I never even knew what we were talking about. You know, being so narrow, dropping the bombs by hand if you had to.
Let's hope it never happens again.
Well, you think we'd learn our lessons, but it doesn't seem like it. And I salute the World War II veterans that are here with us today. Definitely members of the greatest generation. Yes, sir.
I may have missed it, but how long was your father between the time he was shot down and reunited with the troops? How long was that period?
7 months. Yeah, the his Mackie group had set up an ambush for a convoy, and the convoy didn't show up, and then he heard that there were American troops in this little village of Trelon, France. So he went over there, went up to a captain, army captain, and introduced himself and identified himself, and then he went to Paris from there with some prisoners that they were taking over, German prisoners, and then they flew him back to England. He was at his base in England for a little while, and then they went back to the U.S.
What did your dad do after, since he couldn't be a pilot, what did he do after?
He was a flight instructor for a while, and then he had to crash land his plane in Ohio, and then he said, that's it, I'm not flying anymore. And he was a flight instructor in Florida for a while, then Ohio, and then he was in the reserves until 47, and he went out as a captain.
And what year did he die?
2007.
Oh, 2007. And did you do research together before that? Or you said you hadn't been planning the book at that time, but did you do research with him at that time? Was he interested?
No research. I did accompany, my wife and I accompanied my parents in 1994 to the 50th anniversary celebrations in Belgium. And that's really when it became personal for me, because I actually met Nellie Tilquin, one of his helpers, and saw those places where it was hidden. So, you know, that's when it really became real for me. Like most World War II vets, he didn't talk about it much. It wasn't until he went over and the three other living crew members in 1989 to the dedication of the memorial to him and his crew. And there he was reunited with lots of his helpers that he hadn't seen since the war, saw those homes where he had been hidden, and that brought it all back. And then he started talking about it more after that. Yeah, I am very, very fortunate to have as much history and know about so much about my dad's time in the military. Most kids don't know hardly anything about what their dad did because they didn't talk about it. And you know, these gentlemen, they just looked at it as a job to be done. They did their job and they came over and put it behind them. Great men.
So you spent many hours interviewing your father?
Not so much interviewing. At that reunion that we went to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., they filmed him about an hour interview. It's on YouTube. But I, you know, like again, most kids, I wish I had asked a lot more questions than I did. You know, I have a whole list of them I could have asked him. But from all the letters that he wrote to my mother, and he was very candid in these letters. He talked about combat missions. He talked about what life was like in London, what life was like in the base. He talked about escapades that some of his crew members would get in. So I learned a great deal from those letters. And then he would talk about it, the trip to Belgium. And then some of the other surviving crew members wrote recounts, not diaries per se, but in different letters, and then all the research that Jacques Lalot and Paul Delahaye did.
So you're the youngest child?
Yes, I wouldn't be here if my dad hadn't come back. My mother said it was the best mistake they ever made.